Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I love my cooker. I can't imagine living without it now. It's for making drinks or cooking. It's become the essential kitchen gadget for me. If you can afford one, I recommend it. A great bit of kit. Go to cooker.co.uk for more details and to look at the models. Listen, first of all, I've got to apologise. We've had some sound issues on the podcast recently. It's been driving me absolutely mad. And I've got to admit, it turns out that I was, even though I've got a really lovely, nice mic that I bought, I'd not pressed the button to activate it. So the podcast, I've been recording off my internal mic in my computer. I feel so stupid. But I think the content's there. I just apologise about the sound, and hopefully this is sounding a lot nicer. And we're getting loads of emails in now, and I absolutely love it. I'll just do a quick one here. Hi Tim, just wanted to echo the sentiments of the email you were out in the last podcast. I do love the subjects you cover. Some are not that I would ordinarily seek, but your inquisitiveness and the author's knowledge make for compelling listening. I too really enjoy the celebrity editions, and I think you have the right mix. You got it just right. I haven't done a celebrity for a while. I've been sort of inundated with ideas of things that I want to understand, and then authors are approaching me now, and there's so many great books out there about all different things that I'm just like, oh, I'll do this one, I'll do that one, because I'm so inquisitive about it all. As you say, I'm curious, so I've been doing that, but I will try and book some more celebrities soon because I do like doing them as well, and I think it's important. That comes from Mark, by the way. Please email me tim@lovejoy.co.uk if you have anything you want to say, any suggestions. I mean, don't say like, can you get Barack Obama? I might be able to, actually. He follows me on Twitter. I could send him a DM, see if he'll do it. But, you know, if you've got any suggestions for good topics, I think that's where we're at. I love doing them. Life can be tough. Any regular listener to this podcast knows I've had my problems. I'm trying to ask questions of myself and life. Look, there's a lot of people out there touting books, telling you they have the answers. A lot of celebrities are doing it at the moment. I couldn't do a book like that because I still have many more questions than I have answers. So I'd be reluctant to tell you all how you can make it just like me too. I have found a better way of living, though, over the last 5 years, and this podcast has really helped me to do it. It's hard work, though. Hard work to get there. It's not a quick process. And you know what it does take is a lot of relearning. That's what I've discovered. It's like learning a foreign language, like pick up a foreign language. It's going to take you a while because I don't know about you, but I've been completely brainwashed by various views in society and the way we feel it all should work, and it's not conducive to a happy life. Well, it wasn't in my case. Anyway, more learning today. Another great author has come through today. Well, you know, she actually makes documentaries, and she's turned her hand to a book. Today I'm curious about how dangerous concussion actually is in sport. I really can't imagine that they would allow kids to carry on playing contact rugby in schools. So it sounds controversial, or heading the ball in football. Honestly, children under the age of 12 have been banned from heading during training. And look, I imagine it could leave the game completely in the future. It sounds such a weird thing to say, but I've read Hannah's book. Joining me is Hannah Walker Brown, who's written this book, and it's called A Delicate Game: Brain Injury, Sport and Sacrifice. Hannah is a multi-award-winning audio documentary maker. She's created work for Audible, BBC, The Guardian, National Geographic, Spotify and Warner Brothers. Let's meet her. Here's Hannah.
Hannah, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm doing good, thank you. I've just actually got my copies of my book through.
Oh, excellent. I've got one here. It's a beautiful looking book, isn't it? You must be proud of that with all the gold.
I am, yeah. It's gorgeous, I think, is the right word.
It's wonderful that you've got your name actually in gold. That's the important thing. There's for anyone who's wants this described, there's a picture of, I assume that's a rugby pitch, or actually it could be NFL. Actually, it's NFL, isn't it?
Yeah, miscellaneous. We went for
miscellaneous.
Could be applicable to any.
There's all, There's all the lights to do with sport. Just before we get into talking to you, Hannah is a multi-award-winning audio documentary maker. She's created work for Audible, BBC, The Guardian, National Geographic, Spotify and Warner Brothers. Hannah, tell us a bit about yourself before we get into talking about concussion. How did you, you know, what is your career? How did you get involved in it? And what are the subjects you usually focus on?
Sure. Yeah, I guess audio documentary making, that's absolutely right. Podcast writing, I guess fundamentally it sits under this umbrella of storytelling, and it's always been people and human stories that I've been really interested in hearing, but also communicating, platforming, anything where there's been a kind of miscarriage of justice, or, you know, I'm always for the underdog. I think that's comes from growing up working class. But yeah, it's been quite a wild trajectory. It all kind of makes sense if I go back and trace the steps. But I think I've just always been determined to make a bit of a difference, like not in a kind of worthy way, but seeing that I had this skill that was interviewing or holding space for people and deciding to use that for good. And I sort of chose a behind the scenes production life, which is now sort of turning around as I'm stepping into published author life. But that's kind of
What sort of things have you done before?
Oh, so many things. I made a lot of so BBC documentaries was where I started. Everything from cheerleading grannies in the desert in Arizona to, well, children in Bangladesh, women who had been sort of taken out of school, married to much older men and then abandoned in kind of the slums of Bangladesh. So I've been all over the world with stories, to be honest. And yeah, this just felt like the next step, really. I've always loved writing. I've always wanted to write as a kind of career, I suppose. I've done it, you know, at home or on Instagram. I've written a lot of audiobooks, scripts and stuff. But yeah, this is my first kind of foray into published.
Oh, is it? I didn't know that. Work. Okay. Well,
it's a debut.
All right. Well, I thoroughly, when I say I enjoyed it, I'm not sure that's the, I learned a lot and I got an education. I got an education. But the other thing which it did, which was it conjured up emotions for me. It was tough reading parts of it, especially, when you write about Benjamin and what he went through and subsequently the people around him, his mother and everything. So I suppose what you better tell us the principle of the book before we get into it. It's called A Delicate Game, Brain Injury, Sport and Sacrifice. How did you get interested in this subject and what's the point of the book?
Yeah, sure. So it was a few years ago, I was making a piece with the BMX club in Peckham in London. They're quite famous now. Trey White won silver at the Olympics. He's Peckham, born and bred in that at that track with a guy called CK Flash, who's a bit of a institution in Southeast London. And it's in the book, but I was making this BMX doc and so was quite embedded in that world. And someone sent me an article about Dave Mirra, who was a world champion BMX rider, and he had died by suicide. And no one could believe it. Even his mates were texting him to tell him, oh, you'll never guess what the tabloids are saying about you now, because they thought it wasn't real. And anyway, read the article, it transpired he had this disease called CTE and suicide was one of the symptoms. And I just couldn't believe there was something that existed in the world where that was a symptom of a disease. And it sort of just sent me down this rabbit hole. I was doing a lot of research about it. I pitched it to Audible a few times. I actually reread some of the emails I initially sent when I was quite obnoxious in 26 and being like, you have to do this. And every time they were sort of keen, but then they weren't. And I really had to push to get it done. Anyway, I ended up making a 4-part audio documentary with Dawn Astell, the daughter of Jeff Astell, West Bromwich Albion player, who was the first footballer to be diagnosed with CTE, which is essentially what the book is about, an investigation into this disease, but told through kind of the different cases of family. So it's kind of very intimate at the same time as being scientific, but also it unpacks how we got here, like why we have this disease, why concussion is there, and what has enabled sport to carry on functioning and carry on making loads of money essentially out of these people who are being brain damaged.
You better tell us what CTE stands for.
Oh yeah, sure. It's a chronic traumatic encephalopathy. which is a neurodegenerative brain disease caused by concussive or subconcussive hits to the head. So not just the hits that knock you out. This is things like heading a football, going in for a tackle, whiplash, anything that causes the brain to shake. And I always use an analogy of an egg. So if you think about an egg, it's got the yolk in the middle. If you imagine that the shell is the skull and the brain is the yolk. So if you shake that egg, that's essentially what is happening to the brain every time one of those hits happens.
Yeah, and I think it's described as punch drunk, isn't it? That's what we used to call it.
That's where it started, yeah. It started in boxing with punch drunk syndrome, and what they were witnessing was almost like the boxers would come off some of these hits and they would be stumbling around, their speech would be slurred. They might sort of to develop a Parkinson's-like gait in their movement. And yeah, it started as punch drunk in boxing, which does feel like the right sort of place for this to begin, because ultimately the aim of boxing is to knock your opponent out. And I think it's taken a long time to acknowledge, for various reasons, that actually this is happening across sport, because like fundamentally the brain doesn't know what's hitting it. It doesn't think, oh, this is a football, therefore I'm not going to be as damaged, you know, it's all the same. So again, there's many reasons for that, all of which are in the book. But yeah, it's been about 6 years of investigation and research and meeting a lot of families, having the privilege to meet a lot of families. And like you said, it's harrowing and it's heartbreaking, but I do think it's necessary.
Yeah, and I think we have to point out the brain. I've interviewed a brain surgeon on this podcast, actually. Brain's quite a delicate thing. Well, it's not quite. It is a delicate thing. And the substance it's made out of is not like anything else in the body. It's very soft. Yeah. It's not like muscle. We assume it's a muscle. Yeah. It's not a muscle, is it?
No, it's like someone said it's like the when you buy, I don't eat meat, but when you go to supermarket and you buy like some fresh meat, you know, a steak or something to cook later, like it's so malleable. And if you punch that piece of meat, it shifts to the shape of your fist, you know, it doesn't sort of bounce back. And I think there is again a misconception that because the brain is so powerful that it's strong, and it is, but in the same way like an iPhone, right? They're incredibly complex, incredibly intelligent, but you drop it on the floor and it'll smash to 1,000 pieces. So I think that's the thing that we forget, is actually like, yes, it can do all these amazing things, but it really needs to be looked after.
That's one of the analogies in your book, isn't it? Actually, I can't remember how it actually is, but it's like buying some fantastic technology and then kicking it around.
It's basically
like your brain.
Yeah, it's Dr. Willie Stewart, who's an incredible, incredible man. He's done all the kind of studies into this. He's really kind of fighting the good fight. And he described it as, you know, if a football's coming towards you at 40 miles an hour, would you use your flat screen television to stop it? And everyone's like, well, no, why would I do that? Then I'll smash to pieces. And he's like, exactly. So why are you going to do that with the most complex organ in your body? It's nonsensical.
Yeah, so I'm reading your book and it's kind of, when you start reading your book, you start thinking, well, you know, we should just ban sport basically, because it feels that way. And yet I will, you know, I've gone on record many a time saying football, not watching but playing, is one of the greatest things that I've ever done in my life. That feeling of walking on a football pitch, the challenging, the teamwork, winning and losing, the camaraderie. What I noticed once was my depression started when I retired from football. You know, I was only playing amateur football, but I stopped doing that, and I lost that whole thing of what it means to be part of a team and to chat. And I like the challenging. I loved going up for a header. However, I also scarily played a lot with concussion. And if I got concussion on a Saturday or Saturday or a Sunday, I played both, but Saturday, I'd still be training on the Tuesday and the Thursday. When I played, no one ever said you need to take some time out. And that worries me, that I have been playing with this sort of potentially I've done damage to my brain. Who knows? We'll only find out in the long term. But fascinatingly, a large percentage of the 1966 World Cup team have had or died of dementia.
Yeah.
That's correct, isn't
it? Yeah, over half.
Right.
Yeah. And again, you know, I don't I don't want to ban sport by any means. I think sport's incredible, and I know what you mean, you know, that intoxicating buzz of, you know, even if you don't even have a stadium crowd behind you, just being there with people you care about and all working towards the same thing. And I wrote it in the book, you know, how, like, I mean, I live in London. I'm not sure where you are, London, I guess. But, yes. You know, London can be quite mean. People can be a bit cold. But when England are winning in whatever match they're doing, we all come together and it's like the atmosphere is electric. And that is something, you know, no one wants that banned. And in fact, none of the families in this, they're all still sport mad, you know. But it's just about finding a safer way. And even if it's not finding a safer way, it's giving people all the information so that they can make an informed decision. Like you just said, you were never told about these things. And I think if you are, a lot of players would still get on the pitch, right? That's fine. That's up to them. But there does need to be more awareness. And especially in schools, like kids copy whatever they see their heroes do, you know, like they do some weird things when they've seen someone do it on TV. Or like, I've got two nephews, I don't know where their accents come from a lot of the time, but I think if you're seeing your star player or the player you've got a poster of on your wall or, I don't know, on the iPad, whatever, going in for these tackles, taking the brunt of this injury and then getting up and getting back on, you're just going to do the same. So I think it is about awareness and information, and then people can make an informed decision. It's not about saying, no, you know, stop all sport. But I think that, you know, it's smoking, right? We thought cigarettes were all right 20 years ago. Now we know different. So I think we just have to evolve. And the more information we do know, you have to respond.
And I think the other thing you point out in the book is, like, I'd play football Saturdays, Sundays, train Tuesdays, Thursdays. That's a lot of fitness I'm doing. And I'd do other stuff as well because, you know, I was sport mad as a kid. And there is a positive side to playing rugby, AFL, football, everything, as in the fact that you are actually exercising and getting out there and running around. And you do put in that in the book that there are positives which come with these sports. You're not just saying it's all negative. What you're talking about is head injury. However,
yeah,
that head injury is a big part of a lot of these sports. Just before we get into the detail about, how do you feel then writing a book about this? Is your mind racing? Because you can see the fact that there needs to be something done, but you can also see that the authorities are not willing to go on that journey because they know it will radically change the sport. I assume that's why they're not doing it. Is that what you assume?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's millions of reasons why they're not doing it. You can make of that what you will, but it's really hard, I think. And, you know, this isn't a personal fight for me. And what I mean is that I came to this because I wanted to write about it. I wanted to do something about it. I wasn't thrust into it because I've lost someone I really love in a really horrendous way, or I'm now caring for someone who is suffering from brain damage from those head injuries. So that's quite a privileged position to be in. But I do find it infuriating, and it's almost laughable sometimes, the tactics that are kind of used in communicating this, or the vagueness around it. I think one thing is, you know, we just don't have all the information yet. And I would argue there is definitely enough information to make a decision. And in terms of, rather than, you know, safe, better safe than sorry. You know, you don't want to get to kind of another 20 years down the line and realise 100 more rugby players are being diagnosed with dementia at 37, 38, 39, 40, because that is the reality right now. And like 38 with dementia, like, it's unfathomable. But yeah, here we are.
Yeah, let's get back to that in a minute. But I think it would be really important, because everyone just immediately goes, okay, it's professional sport. That's what it is.
Mm.
Though, as you point out in your book, it's not. It's amateur sport as well. And what's the worst bit about it, which is what I mentioned in my intro, it's children. And, you know, there's a case you discuss in the book, Benjamin. If you could just give us a quick summary of what happened there.
Yeah, sure. Benjamin Robinson was 14, and he was playing a game of schoolboy rugby in Northern Ireland. And he basically took multiple hits, should have been taken off the pitch that day, was allowed to play on three times, fourth blow he never wakes up from. And you know, I've spent time with his parents, and it's just utterly devastating that this was the result of a schoolboy match. And he was the best player on the team. You know, there was no way he was going to be taken off. His mum, Karen, was watching it all unfold on the side of the pitch. She wanted him off. She was calling for him to be taken off, was ignored. And, you know, there was an inquest later, and the referee did say he thought that they were just being dramatic, a lot of the boys, when it came to injury. And there was nothing in place that day. No one knew any of the protocol. No one kind of stepped in to say, no, you know, he needs to come off. He was visibly showing signs of a concussion, or something wasn't right. And he basically died of second impact syndrome, which is when you have two successive hits close together. So we hadn't recovered from the first hit. The second one came, and that was it. And it's absolutely heartbreaking. Like, he was 14, and, you know, for a while he became the sort of poster boy, for want of a better word, for concussion. His dad, Peter, leads incredible campaigns in Scotland, Ireland, England. If you've ever seen a rugby match, If in Doubt, Sit Them Out, that's for Benjamin. The banners are sometimes held up. And essentially, rugby, the school, took no responsibility. And, you know, what they're left with is, they have, their son is dead, you know, and that was because no one knew how to manage that situation. And that's a massive problem. And he's not the only one, the only kid that's died of second impact syndrome, which is worrying. And I think a lot of the time the family are told, you know, this is very rare, or which I think, you know, is just really, does a real disservice. And it's quite insulting, I think. But he's not the only one, and it's not rare. And there was no protocol for children that day.
It's beautifully written, by the way, that bit, Hannah.
Thank you.
I had to keep putting the book down, because being a parent, I was quite emotional through that. You really made us understand what it feels like to have a child who just goes out to play something that he loves and everybody rates him, and then he doesn't come home. Well, doesn't ever. You know, he dies for doing something like that. It's just absolutely incredible. It's every parent's worst fear.
Yeah, and I think one thing that is really important, you know, rugby wasn't Benjamin's life. Like, Karen is very, you know, she speaks for herself. I'm by no means a spokesperson for this family. They just, you know, I'm honoured they allowed me to write about their son, but he didn't love rugby. It wasn't his, you know, his dream to be a star rugby player or anything like that, which I think just makes it just even worse. He didn't want to let anybody down that day. He wanted to represent his team, but, you know, it wasn't kind of, I don't know, it's I think someone has said to them, you know, he died doing what he loved, and that's just not quite true. I think that makes it even sadder, you know. There's an innocence to that. He was just going out to play a game. He wasn't bothered either way, and that's what ends up, you know, killing him.
I never played rugby. I tried it once. Oh, I tried it a couple of times, actually, and I must say I didn't like it. It just seemed to hurt a lot.
Yeah,
sorry about that. But what I didn't like about it, and I'm people who play and support rugby here, please don't misjudge me on this, because I think it's a great sport. The people involved in it are amazing. You know, I've interviewed loads of them. The fitness and physical aspect are phenomenal. I mean, these guys are phenomenal. But what I found when I played, and it was just as a kid, I'd much rather football. The people keep on going, get stuck in, come on, you've got to get in where it hurts, and all that sort of stuff. And I was like, no, it does hurt. And it's like, you've got to hit the man hard. And I was like, oh, I'd much rather just do it with my feet and play football. And I wonder if you feel that the protocols we know now are starting to get better in the pro game. So you can see, well, especially in football, because they will talk about it. They'll get a concussion. They'll say he's got a concussion. They're testing him. He has to come off the pitch, blah, blah, blah. But does that get passed all the way down to the school level or the amateur level, where still you must be regarded, it's a man's sport, you have to get stuck in, and that can be a fundamental problem, can't it? Because they're not going to the same protocols as the pro level.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's why these sports exist. They're essentially like preparing men for war, and there's a whole culture of masculinity so ingrained in all these sports. And you only have to look at some of the teachers where rugby is so ingrained in their schools. Like, they're fuming about a lot of this stuff that's going on now, because they don't want to change the game. Like, it's part of their identity. It's part of, you know, their school's legacy. And I think slowly the game is changing, because it has to now because of the litigation. And I would hope that that then would trickle down. But, you know, these games aren't regulated. Also, the professionals have access to some of the best medics in the world, like their team doctors. Like, if you're playing in the, you know, a school field on a Saturday, you're not going to have an elite medical professional around you. I mean, you might by chance, but, you know, often you're sort of just going home again. And I think the one thing, you know, in rugby as well, and in football, is it's the training as much as the match. And I think that's where things need to change. So, you know, you might not head a ball 100 times in a game of football. That would be quite weird. But in training, you will be doing drills, right? So you could be heading the ball 20 times a night, however many times you go to training. And I think that's the thing that really needs to be included in the conversation. It's not just the match. It's everything around it. And football's kind of easy. Like you said, you play with your feet, right? It's an amazing game. It's so exciting. Like we've already said, everyone, you know, it's part of our identity, I think, especially in England. Like, we're not good at much, but sometimes when we're good at football, you know, everybody's just on side. But I think it does need to be interrogated. And again, the professionals do have to set an example, because that's what trickles down, grassroots kids.
Yeah, you just took me back to remembering when we used to do football training. One of the things we'd have to do is they'd smack the ball up really high, and then we'd have to jump up and head it. So it was like from a goalkeeper's kick type thing. And I hated that. I was all right at it, but I hated it, because if you caught it on the wrong part of your head, oh, wow, it would hurt. But now you realise why it does hurt is because your body was going, I don't like that. That's hurting our head. So there was like just the corner bit you had to head it on, and that was considered okay. But even then, I wonder if it was any good, because your brain gets knocked around. And, you know, you talk about schools there defining themselves by rugby. Schools used to define themselves by boxing as well. We would absolutely go mental if a school introduced boxing now, wouldn't we? Can you imagine throwing kids in and going, right, and also because of it is the age groups. You know, you're all 12, you can all box each other, and one's like 6'2" and one's 4'1". You know, it's like it's insane, that idea. And I suppose it's similar, but there's tag rugby. You don't have to do full contact rugby, and that is a great game, and it's great for the sport, and it lets them know how to play it. That would be fine to introduce that, wouldn't it? Are they anti that sort of thing?
I mean, I don't know. I think also, again, it's tied into the culture more than it is. I think it's, you just don't want the thing you love to be bad for you, do you? Like, none of us do. It's like, you know, when you get a horrible story about an actor who's done something really bad, but it's your favourite film, like, you are disappointed, you know? And this is that tenfold, because it's like, you know, this beautiful game that we cherish, and oh, it might not be as good for us. So I think it's the culture that needs to change as much as anything. And most things, as we learn more and we evolve, things shift. You know, we don't do the same things we did 10, 20, 30 years ago. And I think that's the thing that is hard for people to grapple with, is it's not the same game. It doesn't mean it can't be as good or even better, but I think it's letting go of that and moving forwards.
Yeah, one of the things,
rather than actually the game.
Yeah, one of the things you point out in your book, which is something that I saw a graph in it not so long ago, how the size of everybody in all sports, tennis, golf, everything, they've all grown. They've all got heavier, they've all got stronger, they've all got taller. Rugby is insane how it's, since it's gone pro, the guys they get in and they feed them up, and they are huge now. I mean, they're massive, great big guys hitting each other, aren't they?
Yeah, it's wild. It's like the evolution of man, that chart. I know which one you mean, but this is like in 20 years or so. It's like a comparatively short amount of time. And they are like, they're monsters, you know, in size. They're just absolute giants compared to like the skinny guys running around on a rugby pitch when it was first kind of, well, first went professional. But yeah, it's, and that has to be taken into account as well, because that ferocity and that force that you then have behind you. And I think it does sort of lure you into same with wearing helmets, example, NFL. You think you're kind of protected because you've got a helmet on your head, but that's such a, it's a false sense of security, because the helmet, all that does is, if you're you know, your skull cracks, it keeps it together. It doesn't protect your brain. Like, your brain's on your inside of your skull. But I think, you know, you see the helmet, you think safety, and then you can go a bit harder. But essentially, yeah, all that's doing is just making sure if your head does slice apart, it stays intact.
So I suppose that what the helmet does is it stops the actual bone from cracking, though it's not stopping not stopping the brain from wobbling around inside, which is where you get the bruising and where you get the problem. Is that correct?
Yeah, totally. Because the brains will still shake whether there's a helmet on or not. You know, you almost need a helmet around the brain, not around the head, if you're going to stop the brain from shaking.
Yeah, they haven't invented that yet. Have you ever been to an NFL? Have you been to an NFL game?
I have, yes, a long, long time ago.
It's insane, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Oh my God, the way those guys hit each other. It's quite incredible to watch. But the force they go into each other, it's as I say, it's insane. It's so weird to watch.
It is, but again, like, you have that duality where that's all happening, but like the show and the buzz and the lights and, you know, the arena, that is all so exciting, and the audience is running on adrenaline. And I guess a lot of the time, especially when you're watching on TV, it kind of lends itself to that, but you can feel slightly detached from it being real. Like, it feels unreal sometimes when you're watching these things. And I think that's another thing that we really need to kind of interrogate and bring into the conversation. Like, these are real people. They're not kind of, yes, they're elite athletes, but this is happening to real people and real families. And it is a show and it is exciting. And that's why it's so difficult. Like, a lot of the doctors and neuroscientists I spoke to love sport. Like, they're big sporting families. Dr. Anne McKee was from a huge, like, American football family. Can't watch it the same way anymore, quite rightly, because of all the research that she's done, all the brains she's seen, all the families she's had to have conversations with post-mortem, you know. But it's hard because it is such an institution. You know, the NFL owns a day of the week in America, Super Bowl Sunday, right? It's about as big as Independence Day, probably bigger actually, because it's come over here and we all buy into it as well. So I think, you know, it's not easy. It's not easy to, I guess, to communicate that, but also, like, we all do have a part to play, I think.
Well, think about the money, though. Oh. I mean, the money's real as well. As well as the head industry. Tom Brady was over here the other day. He's gone back and he's decided to start playing again. Obviously, he's not the guy hitting. He's the guy being hit. But, you know, these guys are legends. They're heroes. It's quite something to be an NFL player. I imagine it'd be quite hard for you to tell a kid, stop doing it because, you know, stop doing it because of your brain. They'll be going, but everyone else is doing it and I'm going to make a lot of money and I want to carry on doing it. I mean, whose responsibility is it? Is it the parents? Is it the child? Is it the sports? Well, who are you putting the responsibility on? Say, let's take the NFL.
Yeah, I mean, that's it, isn't it? I think there's a really interesting discussion to have about consent. Dr. Bennett Amalu, he kind of says that quite eloquently about, you know, we don't allow kids to smoke or drink or even, you know, have sex. And yet, every weekend, you put a helmet on them, you send them out into the field. And like the Concussion Legacy Foundation in America did this great campaign, and they basically got a load of kids to talk about concussion, trying to spell it, which obviously it's quite a difficult word to spell. A lot of kids are just like, oh, you know, I don't know, or what is it? And they don't really know. And I guess there is an argument to be like, if they don't know what it is and they don't know what the dangers are, should they be doing that? But I think it comes down to parents. I don't think it should be the responsibility. I don't think the school could give consent, but I do think there needs to be more awareness within schools of the dangers, because they need to know what they're going into, and then they still want to do it, that's fine. Like, you can't stop people from doing something. It's not like you're going to ban football.
Well, I've thought about this for years, but I've got daughters and none of them are interested in playing football or rugby. So they've never played it. They play netball. And it's like, netball's a great sport. There's a lot of contact in netball, by the way, when they get to play county and stuff, which my twins did, there's a lot of contact going on. However, it's not a lot of head contact, fantastically. Under the ring there is a bit, but generally it's not. So it's a good, solid sport. But I always thought, if I have boys, because I love football so much, I got so much out of it, you know, and if they went to a school where they were playing rugby, I don't know where I would stand on it, because it's, I realise how much pleasure I got out of the game, and I imagine most people come out of amateur sport without brain injuries. I don't know, what do you think? What are the stats on that?
Yeah, I mean, and I guess just on that, a really important thing is good concussion protocol. Like, if you take someone out of play and they can recover properly, they can be absolutely fine. But it's when it's like the repetitive hits and you're not recovering and you're going back on the pitch every weekend or whatever, because obviously when you're a kid, where do you want to be? You want to be on the pitch with your mates playing rugby or football. But it's the protocol that also needs to change so that these things can happen. And, you know, again, the ferocity of some of those hits, they're not necessary, especially for kids. And it is about adapting that. I think each parent to their own. I know some people will think this is kind of a mission to ban sports. It's absolutely not. And I think everyone informed should be able to make their own decision. But I think until there is sort of enforced and adequate concussion protocol for kids in particular, so I'm not talking about just what the professionals get passed down and then that's mimicked, but actually looking at what do kids need. So for example, like, women are more prone to concussion, we take longer to recover. There's not that much science and research done on women in concussion in particular. That research has primarily been focused on men for a very long time. But what we do know is we do need more recovery time. But there are a lot of women athletes who have just got the protocols that men have. So they're like, okay, they need that time, so you can have that time. But we know that they need longer. So it's things like that, like actually working out what is happening here and what we need to do to make sure it's safe or someone does have adequate time to recover so that they can play the sport they love.
Why would it be different for women and men, not brains?
There's many reasons. Like, our skeletons are different, like our necks. So our bone structure, hormones can affect it. There's loads of different things. There's not kind of a definitive, this is this, and, you know, that's why. But again, that's why there's just a huge need for more research, especially within women, because essentially we just play by men's rules. They've just been adapted. It's like running trainers. I only found out the other day, all running trainers are made for men. They're just adapted for women. So it's the same with most things in the world, but this in particular, it's just been adapted. Whereas actually what we need is, you know, what is actually happening.
There's a book about that. My twin daughters are always telling me there's a book I need to read, which is about how the world has been invented for men and adapted for women.
Invisible Women.
Is there, that's what it's called. Okay, I must read that. I'll have to give that one a go. So let's talk about the organisations then. So the NFL, they've even made a Hollywood film with Will Smith in it. What about concussions? So clearly now the NFL have looked at that and gone, right, we're going to do something about it. Have they, or are they still going, I'm not sure about the link?
Sort of. There was a big, big payout. It wasn't an acceptance of responsibility, but it was a lot of money that was given out. And I think that's kind of something that flies under the radar a little bit, that you assume because money's gone out, it means, you know, an acknowledgement of responsibility, but they didn't technically do that. I think a lot of these sporting organisations sort of sing from the same hymn sheet when it comes to these situations, because like you said earlier, it's not just about changing the game, but also there's a lot of money, a lot of ad spend. It's a big, big, big business sport. So, you know, you open yourself up to all kinds of litigation. And again, it is a minefield. And I think that's what we need to start viewing it as. It's transactional, you know, business asset. And it is bad business to damage your prized assets. But also, you know, you have an influx of people wanting to be in this arena, wanting to have this career in sport. So you're never not going to run out of people that kind of want to be center stage in that respect. So yeah, I think for so long also sport has kind of governed itself, and, you know, that's like asking a kid to mark its own homework. It's never going to give itself a bad grade, you know what I mean? If it's like, you know, if you get an A, you can, I don't know, have a treat, go to Disneyland, whatever. It'll be all A's on that paper. So, you know, sport isn't exactly going to tell itself it's got a problem. And I think, I hope that will change. There was a big parliamentary review in the UK last year, which did find that. It found that sport was self-governing, and perhaps that wasn't a good idea, but sort of remains to be seen what's going to happen there.
Okay, I let's look over here then, as you've mentioned it, but I don't want to keep beating up rugby because that's what it feels like I'm doing. So let's beat up a bit of football, because Jeff Astle, Jeff Astle you were talking about earlier. Jeff Astle, who people know, played football for professional football. It ended up on fantasy football, and he was a star there. So we all sort of got to know him again, sort of the younger generations. And then he died quite young. Was it his 50s? Was he?
Yeah.
And they linked it to heading the heavy balls. That seems to be the excuse, that the balls are heavy and that's why. Is that an excuse, or is that valid? Are the balls now light enough that it's not going to affect brains?
No. And also they can travel much faster now.
Right.
So it's a moot point. There's a few of those that have been going around. I think the recent one was, I don't know, something about playing on different types of grass. Like, there's various things that come into the arena, but I think now is a good time. I think people are starting to take it seriously. They don't just think it's people, you know, scientists that are saying it because they hate sport. I think it's starting now to really, people are taking notice in a way that they are having those conversations.
Okay, but with people like Jeff and the 1966 World Cup team, is it the heading of the ball, or is it concussion whilst they've been playing? Because obviously everyone just used the magic sponge, get back on play. Which one is it? What do they think it is?
With Jeff Astle, his cause of death was industrial disease. That is what the coroner determined. So that was, they said he was the best header of a ball a lot of people had ever seen. And again, the training drills, he'd also taken a lot of elbows to the head, you know, also inadequate concussion protocol. So it is a combination. And I think something like this, you don't know how many hits it will take. It's the same with cigarettes. You don't know if it's like your 50th or your 400th cigarette that might give you lung cancer. You might never get it, you know. So it's sort of, there is a risk involved in all of this. But again, you might get it, you might not. But I think with Jeff in particular, it was the drills and it was heading the footballs, and that was his cause of death. And I think that's why it was so, or it should have been, now it is. And at the time, you know, the Dawn has been fighting for two decades to get this out there.
So with Dawn, she was told by the FA that they were going to investigate it, and then she found out years later they haven't even bothered. So the FA and the PFA, none of them bothered, did they? None of them bothered, they just let it go.
Well, they said they started, although no one's ever really seen anything. And there's an incredible journalist, Sam Peters, who led the Mail's concussion campaign, and he'd done a bit of digging, and he went to the family and he said, you know, I don't think this exists. And no one's really sort of said whether it hasn't. It hasn't. They've said, you know, it was started, it wasn't continued, or there were various excuses. But they're, you know, I think for them that was just, they thought something was being done. They were waiting for years, and to find out it hadn't just felt like the biggest slap in the face, to be honest. And they used that and channeled that into creating the Jeff Astle Foundation, and now they've helped countless people. And what's amazing now is that, you know, for years it was sort of just Dawn on her own a lot of the time, talking about this stuff, trying to engage people in this stuff. And now there are groups popping up all over the place. And I think social media does have a big part to play in that. People can connect a lot easier, but also more and more people are being diagnosed across different sports. And we're starting to see, you know, it's not just kind of one family who are grieving and therefore causing a fuss. This is actually happening across the board.
I so remember getting concussion playing football in this one match, but I was playing well and I felt really good, and I think I'd even scored a goal, and I didn't score a lot of goals, and I remember refusing to go off, and they were going, Tim, you're just wandering around. I'm like, no, I can do it, I'll be all right. And then I remember playing the next week, and, you know, the protocol now is it 2 or 3 weeks you're supposed to not play for? Or, I mean, where are we at with the protocols in sport?
Yeah, they said 12 days. I think a lot of the time, there's a lot of research there, like it should be 3 to 4 weeks. And even then, there is return to play protocols in place. Rugby has them, football has them. And
but that's
again,
at the pro. That's at the pro level, right?
That's not for the pro,
amateur.
Yeah.
So amateur,
and it should
come back next week.
Yeah, and it should be case by case because there isn't a one size fits all. And again, some people will be very symptomatic. So, you know, disorientated, blackout, dizzy, whatever. Some people, they won't even notice. They'll be absolutely fine. And that's the subconcussive hits where there isn't kind of immediate feedback. So you're not stumbling, you're not slurring. You are technically, you appear fine to play on. And I think that's where it, you know, it gets really murky is should any hit take you off? Should there be medical staff there that aren't with the club, you know, because everyone has a vested interest in their team winning, including medical staff to some degree. I'm not suggesting that, you know, they wouldn't help someone that was in danger, but I think especially like you were, you've got someone saying, no, I'm good, I can play, and they're not showing any of those symptoms. That's where it just gets, like, it's a minefield.
Yeah, I actually went out that night and I remember being out in a bar, our local bar, and I'd had a beer and I remember being so confused and I was looking around, I was like, I just couldn't make sense of anything. And eventually I had enough sense in me to go, I need to go home because I'm just not enjoying. I don't think it was because I was confused. I wasn't enjoying myself because I had no idea what was going on. My brain was so confused by it. And then, but it does make me think on reading your book how many times I got hit in the head. And, you know, I was a midfielder. We used to battle for headers and everything else. And the amount of times I took a hit and then was fine. So I carried on. But, I'd wake up the next day feeling a bit of headache. So the amount of times we must have played with concussion. And, you know, hopefully I'm one of the lucky ones who didn't end up getting, well, I maybe didn't play at a high enough level for long enough that I bothered, you know, that I did hit enough impact. But where are they at now, though? Are football and rugby taking this thing seriously yet or not? I mean, how angry are you with them?
Yes, they are, but they're also not. I think there's still a long way to go. I think, you know, there's still matches on where someone is clearly visibly concussed and they're being let back on, or they're taken off and then a week later they're brought back on. And I think it infuriates a lot of people, especially, you know, you feel like you're taking one step and then it's sort of four steps back situation. But, you know, there are good things happening. There are amazing grassroots foundations being set up that can challenge them. There are also, people are starting to work more collaboratively, which I think is really important. And I think for so long it's sort of been a, you know, hero villain situation where it's kind of been the families against the sport. And I think slowly they are coming together because, and football especially, like Dawn Astle, for example, has been working with the PFA to create, you know, dementia funds and support families and, you know, having someone like her with them, I think is absolutely essential to move things forward. So I think it is happening. I'd say it's really crazy because when I first did that documentary years ago, nothing was happening. And I'd say in the last year, it's just gone mad. You know, the rugby litigation kind of helps with that. It just threw it into another arena. All the lights were on. I think now there has to be change because everybody is watching. And the more research that's done, the more science it can be rooted in. Like, you can't keep denying something that is fact, essentially. So I think it's getting there. I don't think it has to be as contentious or as much of an argument anymore. I think there is still elements of that. But I would hope that we are moving in the right direction.
I wonder if it's the wrong way around. Like, the pro sport is becoming sort of more responsible and the amateur and kids isn't. I wonder if it should be, because we, like, if you get into a car and you're going to do F1, there's a chance you might crash.
Yeah,
right, you know that.
Yeah.
There's a bit in your book where Roy Keane, I sort of agree with him as well, he's quoted as saying in a press conference, if you're worried about the physical side of any sport, then play chess. And that is true too, because, you know, if you're going to play football, you're going to get injuries. I interviewed an NFL player once and he said the injury rate in NFL is 100%. There's not a chance you're going to go through your career without being injury. But the rewards are huge. I mean, that's the thing. The problem with this is, is it can be a death sentence if your brain gets injured, but we don't know that. So it's a real minefield, isn't it? You must see that we want the sports to be competitive. We want people to challenge for the ball. There's going to be head injuries. We all remember Terry Butcher with the bandage and the blood coming down his head, and what a hero he was. He played on. Obviously, he should have been taken off because he had blood pouring out of his head. So he must have taken a bang to the head. But it's such a balancing act, isn't it? It's very hard for people to work out where we go with this, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'd also interrogate that. Why is that heroic? Why is that violence celebrated? And I think that is rooted in, again, I'd say that's quite archaic now. And, you know, obviously, this whole idea of like it's a man's game. And I think that is, again, comes back to the culture. Like, why is it we see someone staggering around, blood coming out of their head, and go, oh, what a hero? Why aren't we going, what a bloody idiot? Like, get him off the pitch, recover. But there is that element of it that they say we'd like gladiators, we worship that. And I think that is the crux of the issue, is why.
And I get that, but the bit where you like, one of the things I loved in football was a 50-50 challenge, because it took guts and you had to go in and you were like, I know it's with your feet and not with your head, but yeah. A challenge with the head as well and stuff like that. And it was like, there's something, you get such an adrenaline buzz off it. I've never replaced the buzz of getting on a football pitch and just running around and challenging and trying to win a ball. And it's a beautiful feeling to actually do it. And so I understand that, you know, people are still boxing. You wouldn't get me in a boxing ring for love nor money because I'd be too scared. But people are still doing it.
Of course.
And because they love it. I mean, the rise of MMA is off the scale at the moment. The amount of young men and young women, actually, who are starting to do MMA, their parents are letting them do it. There must be times where they're getting contact on the head. Jiu-jitsu, I don't know what the hell's going on with jiu-jitsu, but I tell you what, lots of people are doing it, and I imagine the head's getting rattled around a bit on that. But I just don't know enough about those sports. Have you looked into combat, the martial arts?
Yeah, and again, like, just to reiterate, like, the brain doesn't know what's hitting it. It's all the same. I have friends that do MMA, and they'll get black eyes. That's a hit to the head. I had an MMA fighter message me on Instagram recently, listened to the audiobook of, it was called The Beautiful Brain that I made before this book. And he listened to it by chance and he said it's completely changed how he approaches his fights, approaches his recovery. He still wants to do it because, like you said, he absolutely buzzes on it. The adrenaline, like that, it's like taking a drug, right? And yet he said now, you know, he has that awareness. It does make him think, is he going to be thinking when he's in a fight and the adrenaline's going? Probably not. But will he maybe recover better? Will he take that time he needs? Maybe. Like, I'd hope so. He said he would. But so I think that's it. And you, again, I can't stop anyone doing it. I would never want to deny someone from that feeling, like that just immeasurable pleasure of being on that pitch, like you said, and guts and that challenge and overcoming something. And I think that's where we really kind of get those highs, isn't it? When we make that challenge and we overcome it, and that could be in anything. But I do think that the awareness isn't there. And also what I think is there are so many families who are going through this, who are suffering, and they don't know what it is, or they don't know where to go. And I would hope this would be a resource for them, enable them to find other people, enable them to talk about it, enable them to kind of, I guess, interrogate what's happening and maybe be able to make changes. And also just for parents with kids, so that they can make an informed decision, not rely on the school to protect the children.
Yeah, well, you should take the decision away from parents. It's not fair on them, I don't think. I know, I really do. I just think it's an unfair decision to make, because the kid will be going, I want to play whatever sport it is because all their mates are doing it. And you're going to be the one going, I mean, my mum played me, like, I played cricket, right? And I was a wicket keeper. On the second or third match, a ball hit my tooth and my mum went mental and made me wear a gum shield. I was the only cricketer to wear a gum shoe. I felt so stupid. So I did it for like, everyone laughed at me. But she was like, no, you're not losing your teeth for a crap, like, you know, children's cricket match, because the pitches aren't level, are they? And I was like, I can't wear a gum shield, Mum. That's ridiculous. Yeah, you know, you wouldn't send a boxer into a ring now without a gum shield, would you? Because, you know, he loses teeth, yet we have no idea what's going on in the brain. Yeah, I feel strongly that parents shouldn't have to make the decision, that we should, as authorities, or, you know, as adults, the adult community should be going, look, we can't put children in danger, because you're right, it's not their consent either. We need to... But that's something we need to think about. I know they're calling in football. It's under 12s now, isn't it, for no heading the ball in training. There's massive call for no heading for under 18s. And I do believe in 2021, though there's been a pandemic, so whether anything happened, I do believe they tried to play a football match with no heading, like a proper game. I don't know how that came about, but there are people calling for just taking heading out of football. That could work quite easily, I think.
It could, and they are limiting heading now in training, although, you know, again, it's cumulative. We don't know how many cause this disease. It, you know, if it does cause it, we don't know what that number is. So does it make a difference? Nobody knows. And football, it'd be very easy to take out heading, right? Like you said, it's played with your feet. Rugby, NFL, that's harder to manage. There are alternatives, but again, everyone needs to be on board. And that's when, you know, you try it. Kids are... They got imagination, they get creative, right? If you told them, go and invent a new game, you'd have one in 5 minutes. But I think, you know, the point about parents think is absolutely right. But I think what is essential is protocol, like concussion protocol that is enforced, school, grassroots, professional, so that, and training, so that if you are a PE teacher or a coach, you know what to do, rather than, you know, relying on someone else there or being like, oh, he's all right. I think, you know, everybody there. And it's true, you know, when you send your kid to school, like, you know, you think they're safe because their people are there to protect them, and that shouldn't disappear on a pitch. And it doesn't in a lot of places, you know. But I think that needs to be paramount. So everybody is like, you know, everyone knows the rules. Everyone knows how to keep everyone safe.
I seem to remember in rugby, the few times I played a bit when I was a kid, I seem to remember when the ground was too hard, too frozen, they made us play touch rugby because otherwise we could injure ourselves on the hard floor. There's nothing ever about the heads. It was always about the floor being hard, and I suppose getting bruises doing that or breaking bones, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I think, but the head is, it's hard to, you know, if you cut your leg and you see blood, you know, you're instantly like, or a broken bone, that crack a bone, or it's more difficult with the head. It's like mindfulness, for example. We can't really see it. Does it exist? Do we know what it is? Like, it's a practice, but it's not like going to the gym where you can physically see the difference. And I think that's something, like, no pun intended, but we need to get our heads around that, because it's still sort of so unknown to us, or it's not recognised in the same way that, you know, a broken wrist or a cut on the faces, you know.
I suppose with football, what they could do is if they got rid of the heading in the game, say for instance, they could also get rid of the offside law, because then you wouldn't ever want to lump the ball up to the big centre forward, because he's going to have to take it on his chest. So that's too hard a skill if you've got a defender tackling you next to it. So it would create the game that the ball would be more on the floor. I don't know why I'm going through this with you.
I don't know. I feel like you need to write a letter to the FA. Tim's Tim's figured it out.
I'm thinking it through. Yeah, yeah. Football 2.0. Yeah, yeah, I'm inventing a new
game.
Football.
Exactly. Now, creative imagination.
Yeah, now, because things can change, can't they? Yeah. I mean, they try to make, as I say, they try and make F1 as safe as possible, because we want to see the racing, we don't want to see the drivers die. If you ever watched the documentaries in the 70s and stuff, when they were dying all the time, because that sport was just horrific. And I suppose that's where we're at we're at a crossroads with these sports. It's just the officials are the governing bodies are just maybe not recognizing enough. Now, if you are a parent, right, you're listening to this, you're a parent, you've got a boy or a girl and they want to play rugby or MMA or whatever, then where should you really be going to look at the information? Because I'm sure a lot of parents are listening to this going, holy shit, I don't want my kids to be doing this. And it does sound horrific. What should they, apart from read your book, which is a great read, where else can they go to try and find out information about this? And what can we be doing as a society?
I'd say concussion Ocean Legacy Foundation is a great place to start. They began in the US, but they have a UK kind of constituency now. But they have so many resources, case studies. They're the ones that did the campaign with children. I'd definitely go there. I'd say if you are reading the book and you have a personal connection to concussion, like, take it slowly, because like you said, it can be quite harrowing. Important, heartbreaking, but take it easy. But yeah, Concussion Legacy Foundation, I'd say, is a great place. And actually, you know, a lot of the sporting bodies do have their protocol on their website. So in rugby, they've got the SCAT test, which you can download. The information is there. You just have to look for it a little bit harder than I think is acceptable at the moment. And I wouldn't say that they've really pushed that to the centre. It's there if you look for it. But yeah, I'd say Concussion Legacy Foundation is one of the best resources if you're looking for information.
Brilliant. Hannah, just quickly, what are you up to next? What are you focusing on next? What's your next book or project about?
Oh, God. Well, this has been like quite a labour of love. I have got another book that will come out in 2024. Another investigation, moving away from sport and into misogyny. So another kind of nice and light topic to get my head around. So yeah, between then and now, multiple podcast projects, that's sort of my main job.
Perfect. Well, hopefully you can come back and talk about them. I mean, if anyone wants to follow you, where should they go? Where's the best place? Twitter, Instagram?
Twitter for book stuff. I'm on Instagram, I'm on Twitter. It's just my full name. You can find me, Hanna Walker Brown.
Yeah, Hanna Walker Brown. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Hanna. Thoroughly enjoyed that conversation.
Pleasure. Well, thanks for having me.
And scary as well.
Well, yeah. Enjoyed. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tim.